from 89.3 KPCC. This is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. We're going to start today's show with the latest on the fires burning in California. Now, we're receiving word right now that a small brush fire has broken out in the Eagle Rock Hills near the 1800 block of Yosemite Drive. That's about 1.5 acres right now. Eagle Rock High School is under a shelter-in-place order. In the San Bernardino foothills, the old water fire has consumed 75 acres and is 30% contained. Things are a lot more troubling, though, north of us, where the fast-moving Kincade Fire is blackening Sonoma County. That fire has consumed 10,000 acres. 2,000 people have been evacuated. Some of those fleeing the flames have ended up in Healdsburg Community Center, south of the flames. And KQED reporter Tiffany Kamhai is there now. Tiffany, welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Tiffany. So what are you seeing from where you are?
So right now there is a thick layer of smoke. I've been here for about 5 hours now, and I think the winds have shifted a bit because the smell of wildfire smoke has finally gone away. It was pretty suffocating earlier this morning. There is what looks like snowflakes, but it's actually ash coming down. A lot of evacuees are filtering in here.
And speaking of those evacuees, many of them are people that are farm workers from vineyards in Sonoma. What have they been telling you?
That's right. So I talked to one farm worker from Mexico. He has worked in the vineyards here in Healdsburg for 3 years, and he said two out of those 3 years he's had to cut short the harvesting season because of wildfires.
Now, this fire is burning close to where the Tubbs fire burned just last year. Is there a sense of, like, just a dread of here we go again among the people that that are there?
I heard those exact words from some evacuees over here. Some of them were from Geyserville, which is near Healdsburg, and they were actually, you know, they kind of felt some relief with the public safety power shutoff from PG&E, thinking we don't have to worry, you know, now that the power shut off. But one started again late last night, and he said those exact words, here we go again.
One more thing, Tiffany. You mentioned how the winds are shifting a bit. How hot is it there right now, or how hot does it feel?
Oh, it feels so hot. I think it's around 90 degrees. And the wind is picking up. Luckily, like I said, it's blowing the smoke somewhere else, but it's very, very hot.
That's KQED reporter Tiffany Kamhai at an evacuation center south of the Kincade Fire. Tiffany, thanks a lot and stay safe.
Thank you.
To housing now. Our California Dream collaboration is looking for solutions to some of California's most pressing problems. In this case, homelessness and projects going on across the state that save taxpayer money by housing the most vulnerable homeless people, those who cycle from the streets to the emergency room and back again. KPCC's Matt Tinoco reports on the progress that's been made through the LA County program called Housing for Health.
Ebony Palmer is finally beginning to calm down.
The paranoia went down tremendously.
Though she's only 25, she's already spent years homeless. About a year ago, she became one of the lucky ones who the LA Homeless Service System matched with housing. It's the first time she's felt secure in a long time.
Like, when I moved here, I had them change the windows because I thought someone was going to come in and get me.
The byproduct of a traumatic time spent living in hotel rooms, her car, and on friends' floors. She was a foster child, and she grew up in South LA. She fell into prostitution, which was her main mode of survival during her teens and early 20s. Now, she lives in a two-bedroom unit in a dingy mid-century apartment building in Pomona. Her two kids are there too. It was when she became pregnant with her second child that she realized she needed to change her situation.
My main focus was this, where is this baby gonna live?
She knew she couldn't raise her in a hotel room, so she started looking for help.
There's gotta be something for pregnant and homeless. Former foster youth, like there has to be.
She got a case manager and was matched to a county program called Housing for Health. It's a public intervention that covers rent for people who are or could quickly become the so-called high utilizers, those who cycle endlessly through the medical and justice systems. It's the LA vanguard of the state's Whole Person Care pilot program, which does similar things in more than 24 California counties. So she has stable housing now, as do her two children, who would have likely wound up in county custody if she kept on being homeless.
Yes, we got someone off the street, so they're safer. But we've also provided an environment where those children can develop to the highest potential possible.
John Backus is the CEO of LA Care, the managed Medi-Cal program in Los Angeles County. LA Care provides millions of dollars for housing for health. The core problem is that there's little to keep the very poorest Californians who can't keep up with the cost of living from falling down to the street. This is Sarah Mayen, who works for Housing for Health.
It sort of seems like the homeless system becomes the safety net of last resort.
Housing for Health is part of that system and an attempt to make up for decades of cuts to the American social safety net. It provides housing assistance for about 11,000 people. And that provides something else, a steady mailing address so that the formerly homeless can consistently access what's left of that safety net. The biggest sell is how it saves taxpayer money. This is Libby Boyce, Housing for Health's program director.
When somebody's really vulnerable living out on the street, they are costing a lot of money just by visits to the ER, ambulance rides, police interventions.
Like Ebony. She says she'd gone to jail at least 6 times for prostitution and was on the cusp of becoming chronically homeless.
For that person, it is cheaper to help them.
A study by the RAND Corporation of LA's Housing for Health program specifically found that for every dollar invested in the program, LA County saved $1.20. It costs less to cover someone's rent than it is to pay for their medical bills while they deteriorate on the street outside. The biggest challenge, though, is just the supply of cheap housing in California is largely non-existent. Even if you have a voucher, it's very hard to find somewhere to use it. Here's LA Care's Backus again.
Well, right now, we're not helping on the supply side. We're doing a little bit on the demand side.
Ebony doesn't have to worry about that anymore. Instead, she can focus on her baby daughter, Zuri, and she's got big plans for her upcoming birthday.
Because now I have a budget, and I've been saving, and I've been planning, so now I'm able to do that. Give her her first birthday party, and I'm really proud of myself.
She says it's her first year in many of not being homeless. From Los Angeles, I'm Matt Tinoco.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Los Angeles has set an ambitious target for electric vehicles. Mayor Eric Garcetti's Green New Deal includes a goal in that 25% of all new car purchases be zero-emission vehicles in just 5 years. But there's a problem. All those new EVs, they need a place to plug in, too. KPCC's Sue Carpenter tells you about an innovative plan to bring EV charging to the streets of L.A.
I've owned electric cars since 2011, so I have a routine that I do at least once a week.
So I just got home from work, going over to my EV charger in my driveway. And we're charging.
At the risk of humble bragging, I consider myself fortunate to not only own an electric car, but also my house, where I'm able to charge it. But 2/3 of Angelenos are renters, and they need places to charge too. So the city has come up with a novel solution: streetlights. Specifically, tapping into their energy to charge EVs through an app, like this one around the corner from my house in Highland Park.
So, here we are. Garden variety light post. Except that what's attached to it is a box, which is an EV charger. It's got a long cord hanging out of it, and the way to get it released is to unlock it through the app. You plug it into your car. Basically, this is a parking spot that has always been here. It's just been converted to an EV charging spot, and you can tell because it has this big flag up above it that says EV charging station.
When the city decided that one of their priorities was to encourage the purchase of EV vehicles, it seemed prudent that it would be best to attach EV charging stations to our light poles, which would eliminate another piece of equipment to be constructed into the sidewalk. and utilize our circuitry.
That's Norma Isahakian, director of the Los Angeles Bureau of Street Lighting. The reason that's even possible, she said, is because the city just converted most of its streetlights to energy-saving LEDs. That freed up enough electrical capacity to enable EV charging from the same piece of infrastructure. The stations are operated by a handful of companies. Some of the big ones are Greenlots, ChargePoint, EVgo. It's their apps you download, depending on where you want to charge. And yes, there's a fee. It's usually $1 to $2 per hour to use. But the parking? It's free.
I don't know if it's available. Looks like it is being used, which is a good thing.
That's LA Department of Transportation Parking Administrator Ken Husting, pulling up to the agency's first public on-street EV charger at the corner of 4th and Main Street downtown.
This is our pride and joy. This is where it started.
That was in 2016, when EV cars were still a novelty. Back then, finding a place to charge was one of the reasons people weren't buying. And that's still the case. So the city wanted to remove that barrier.
And really, this is to support the conversion and incentivize people to, you know, go green and go electric.
To do it, the Los Angeles Department of Transportation partnered with the LA Department of Water and Power and the Bureau of Street Lighting. It's also beginning to convert some of its off-street spaces, like the new Aiso parking garage in Little Tokyo. Drive down the ramp and a row of Chevy Volts and other EVs catches my eye. They're clustered in the corner, plugged into all six of the Level 2 chargers. There's also a fast charger, but that isn't being used. That one gives you up to 180 miles of range in an hour, and you pay for it by the minute.
Whenever we convert a surface lot to a parking garage, 5% of those will be EV ready.
It's a daunting challenge, because here's the rub. Just 106 of the city-owned parking garage spaces and 200 of its metered street spots have EV chargers right now. The Bureau of Street Lighting plans to add 150 more EV chargers each year. Most of them are being paid for with grants from the California Air Resources Board and California Energy Commission. But the city still has a long way to go to get to the 28,000 public EV chargers by 2028 that are called for in the Green New Deal.
We're nowhere near where we need to be to support those.
That's Joel Levin. He's executive director of Plug-in America, a national advocacy group for EV drivers. It's a chicken and egg situation. He said people won't buy EVs unless they have places to charge them. Still, LA currently has the most public EV chargers of any city in the country.
The national model.
Even if it still has a long way to go to support a mass market conversion to electric vehicles. It's getting there. One EV charger at a time. For KPCC, I'm Sue Carpenter.
Other cities are also adding EV chargers, including Glendale, Santa Monica, Pasadena, and earlier this month, South Pasadena. We turn now to electricity generation. Southern California Edison is considering shutting off power to nearly 400,000 customers today. It's a preemptive measure in case heavy winds knock over transmission lines that could spark a wildfire. Now, the move follows controversial outages in the Bay Area, and it's raising an important question. Isn't there a better way to produce and transmit electricity? Jack Brower is an engineering professor at the University of California at Irvine. He's also director of UCI's National Fuel Cell Research Center. Professor Brower, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
Now, a lot of people aren't familiar with the term microgrid. So briefly explain what a microgrid is.
Yes, it's a small grid in comparison to the larger macro utility grid network that is comprised of end users, so regular customers that use electricity and heat, and storage and generation resources that together could fend for themselves, okay, during a power outage by using the renewable solar or the fuel cell power and the storage that they have on site.
Now, when we talk about microgrid, though, I think people think, oh, it's tiny because of the word micro in it. So how large or how small of an area are we talking about? A city block, a neighborhood? What's the range there?
Yeah, so the range is varied. When we talk about a microgrid, our campus, for example, is a microgrid, and we have over 100 buildings, and we serve a community that's about 50,000 people every day. So that's a fairly large microgrid. but it can be ranging in sizes down to even individual buildings. But it's actually called micro because it's still very much smaller than the utility grid network at large.
But when it comes to microgrids, then how could they be used to help prevent wildfires? Because this obviously is a higher tech solution, possibly.
So they would allow the macro grid, that controlled by PG&E and Southern California Edison, for example, to shut off in various locations and allow the users themselves to both produce their own electricity, but then to also share it with neighbors.
So potentially, how wide of a net could that be? Say it was a hospital nearby, or maybe people that need to refrigerate medication. How wide of a net could be cast to share that power?
Well, that totally depends on the resources for generating power that are available. So, for example, on our campus, we could power roughly neighbors that are almost the same size as our entire campus. And you can see it's already a more high-tech solution than just turning it off.
Jack, what are the drawbacks to microgrids?
So there are challenges and risks associated with the emergence of those technologies as commercially viable. What I mean by that is solar PV electricity has become very inexpensive. Battery energy storage technology is still a little too expensive for most people to invest in.
Is that a time thing, though? I mean, later, say like 20, 30, 50 years, that might not be an issue?
Correct. I'm quite sure that it won't be nearly as much of an issue. But unless you have, you know, a pretty continuous demand, you know, it's difficult to beat like the rates that the electric grid can provide. But if you add into the resiliency aspects that fuel cells and batteries and solar together could provide in microgrids, I think you're going to find that it's extremely less expensive than the losses associated with outages.
Sure. We're talking to Jack Brower, engineering professor at the University of California at Irvine. He's also director of UCI's National Fuel Cell Research Center. Now, all these wildfires have been drawing a lot of attention to various issues about how our power supply works here. And one of them has to do with solar panels. And a lot of people have been a little surprised to find out that having solar panels won't necessarily keep the power on. Now, Professor, can you explain why that is?
Yes, that is because of rules that have been established for the interconnection of solar photovoltaic panels on our rooftop. If, for example, the power goes down and your home is allowed to continue generating electricity and powering and exporting that power, then what could happen is a lineman could come to repair the line and find himself at risk for that hot line. You would have to, again, invest in switchgear to be isolated from the grid and then keep operating. This would be essentially a residential, I would call it nano grid.
You're getting smaller and smaller.
But that could actually keep the lights on in one's own home, and we'd have to also have utility policies that would allow these sorts of things to be regularly installed.
Now, say if solar panels are tied to the grid, there's a way to keep the lights on even if the grid goes down, though. Battery energy storage, is that a possibility when it comes to solar power?
Yes, as a matter of fact, battery energy storage is a very good option and becoming increasingly cost-effective for short periods of energy storage. Some areas in PG&E service territory, they were out for 2 or 3 days. Then the batteries are not capable of storing that much electricity. Then an alternative of using fuel cell technology.
Well, let's get into the fuel cells because you are director of UC Irvine's National Fuel Cell Research Center. So briefly tell us how fuel cells work.
So fuel cells are similar to batteries in that they are electrochemical energy conversion devices. So they do not burn fuel like combustion applications. That's a very important aspect of a sustainable energy future, okay? And they electrochemically convert the fuel and oxidant to electricity and do so with high efficiency as well as zero criteria pollutant emissions.
Jack Brower is an engineering professor at UC Irvine. He's been speaking with us about microgrids. Jack, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. And just a quick update. There is a fire burning right now in Agua Dulce. It's called the Tick Fire, and it's scorched about 200 acres. Structures are a threat, and we'll keep you posted throughout the afternoon on All Things Considered right here on KPCC. So keep it tuned in to 89.3. All right, now back to Take 2. Prize fighting used to be a big pastime a century ago.
A roar goes up as the champion makes his way to the ring. The moment of truth approaches. The challenger strides down the aisle. The fighters shake hands.
Even here in California, it was hugely popular. That is, up until the Friday evening of August 22nd, 1913, when heavyweight boxer Jess Willard delivered a deadly blow to his opponent, Jack Bull Young's jaw. Jess Willard, the city of Vernon, and prize fighting in California is the topic for today's Throwback Thursday.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
Julia Brickland is a local author who specializes in California history. She's here to give a 1-2 punch on what happened way back in 1913. Julia, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
All right, so tell us the story of that evening when heavyweight boxer Jess Willard fought Jack Bull Young in Vernon, California.
Jack and Jess were thought to be a little unevenly matched. They were both very, very large men.
Jess Willard is 6 feet six, 260 pounds. He's from Pottawatomie, Kansas, and determined never to go back.
Bull Young was not any slouch either. He was often referred to as a wall of granite. Oof. And different nicknames built on rock. And so when both of them got in the ring together, promoters thought this could go quite a few rounds. As it turns out, it did. But on the 11th round, Jess threw a punch, hit Bull Young in the jaw, and knocked him flat out. And Jack Young never really regained consciousness. Ooh. They took him to the hospital. He suffered brain swelling. And at about 3 a.m. the next morning, he succumbed to his injuries.
Wow. So he didn't last very long. And I can't imagine how Willard must have felt afterwards.
Oh,
I mean, he killed a man with his bare
hands.
Oh,
sure.
So what was his reaction to Young's death?
It's not what you would have thought. I mean, this man who was, you know, a giant, was crying and sobbing and pacing back and forth at the hospital. He was in disbelief that his punch had actually killed this man. According to his many, many, many statements, he'd never intended to give a knockout punch. And in fact, he thought he didn't even give his hardest punch. According to him, he just lightly tapped him on the jaw as sort of a strategic move and had no idea of the devastation that he would wreak on this man.
So let's talk a minute about who Willard was. How was he regarded in the boxing community at the time?
Jess Willard was sort of, he was much smarter than people gave him credit for. And I think that's because he was seen as this really huge, lumbering, oafish guy. But in fact, he was a very thoughtful guy. And though he didn't really much care for the business aspects of his boxing career, he very much cared about people. He grew up in a tiny little town in Kansas. He was a cowboy. At various times, he did odd jobs. He chopped wood. He did anything he could to give his family some money to subsist. And in fact, he didn't even get into boxing until he was 27, 28 years old, when many others were leaving. Boxing to him was a way to make money, but it wasn't necessarily his life's dream or joy.
So it sounds like he was a sweetheart who just happened to box because he was big.
Absolutely.
And strong. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. To put him into context for us, give us a sense of prize fighting culture at this time. Was it widely accepted?
Prize fighting was widely accepted. It just wasn't polite to say that you participated in watching it. Progressivism and the progressive era had largely made prize fighting something that was outlawed in many states and many counties in this country. It was seen as brutal, a return to Roman times when Romans were declining and putting slaves in the arena and punching each other until one of them died. It was seen as uncivilized and really up there with the other vices, with gambling, with prostitution, with drinking. These four things, these three things plus boxing and sparring and prize fighting, were really seen as the four ills of society.
Well, yeah, it's seedy. I can already picture a scene back in those days, a boxing ring, smoke probably all over the place, dim lights. I mean, it definitely has this feel of someplace that you shouldn't be, right?
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what about the city of Vernon where this all happened? Mm-hmm. Why was it open to prize fighting if LA maybe outlawed boxing in 1907?
Well, the city of Vernon still has a long history of being an outlier. It is an unincorporated city in California, so it's allowed to do some things that the city of Los Angeles or, say, various cities in Orange County or really any incorporated city in California is not allowed to do. So Vernon was the place that people went to. It's only 8 miles south of Los Angeles proper. If you wanted to drink, if you wanted to perhaps squire a lady or a man who was not necessarily your spouse, you could take a trolley car to Vernon. You could perhaps stay up and participate or see some plays that were not necessarily in good taste. And so Vernon really was the place to go blow off steam and do things that you would not necessarily be able to do in LA proper.
So Vernon was basically our own little Sin City right next door.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, that fateful fight in August of 1913, what happened to Willard? What wound up happening to him? Did he face legal repercussions?
Oh, yeah. So as soon as Bull Young passed away, Willard and 11 others connected with the fight that evening were arrested. Initially, Willard was charged with manslaughter. Later, that charge didn't seem like it could stick. Part of that is because of Willard's good nature and the fact that he had no intention of permanently harming Young. But yes, he went to trial later the following year in 1914, and the public watched this trial very closely, as did fight promoters all over the United States.
So what were the repercussions of this outcome in the years that followed?
For years after that court case in 1914, it was still very murky about what politicians could do to curtail prize fighting or otherwise streamline ordinances that had to do with public fighting, especially in California, Nevada, Utah, other states that were Western states that were still sort of on the Wild West of trying to figure out what public fighting between two men or two women might actually entail.
That's Julia Bricklin, local author who specializes in California history. Julia, thanks for taking the time.
You're very welcome.
Right, it is spooky season. That's right, Halloween, just a little over a week away. So we want to know, do you have an eerie LA story like this one?
All of a sudden, I hear this sound. It sounded like children or high pitch, some cackling. And I go into the living room. I look over and I see transparent ghosts, these apparitions. You could see right through them and they were just kind of floating. JL, get out of here, get out. And all of a sudden, they just took off up the stairway, up to the second floor loft, leaving behind, I'll never forget, it was the smell of a burnt match.
Do you have a tale that's scary, creepy, eerie? We want to hear it. Go to our Facebook, we're at Take Two Show, and click on the Halloween call out to submit your story to us so it can be featured on our show on Halloween.